Welcome to Equiosity, the podcast about all things equine, with a special emphasis on the horse-human bond. My name is Alexandra Kurland. I'm the author of Modern Horse Training and many other books and DVDs about clicker training. And I'm joined by Dominique Day, one of the co-founders of Kavalia. So, Dominique, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, you know, I'm in the rope handling course now. And you know how much I love stories and images?
Yes.
And there was a story that you told in that course that I love. And it's in a segment where you explain that when you're doing rope handling, and perhaps we should, well, I don't know, you decide if you want to start with the story or explaining the meaning of what you were trying to illustrate. But so you say you close some doors, but there is always one door open. That's very important because for the horse, a door can be closed without creating a scary situation. They're not blocked. There's always something open, but not all doors are open.
Right.
And you tell the story of your father and the treasure hunts on birthday.
Yes, I love the treasure hunts.
Yeah, so can you talk about that a little bit? Because you know, one of the conclusion, just to make, because I don't know if you remember vividly the story that I'm talking about and why you were telling this story. Do you remember? Because I don't want to give the punchline, but...
Well, I don't remember exactly, because I tell it frequently, so I don't know what the punchline here is specifically. So let's jump in, and if we miss the punchline, you can...
I'll add it at the end.
You can add it, right. So where to begin? So many of the way that we see training and the training choices and the way that we watch training, that how one person can watch a trainer working and be totally at ease while the person sitting next to them is squirming, really uncomfortable with what's going on. You know, what is all that about? It's the same event, and yet it's seen from two very different perspectives. One person is saying, this is fine, I'm fine with this. And the other person is saying, how quickly is this going to be over? I need to leave. I don't like this at all. So, of course, a lot of this goes back to our own personal experiences. And I remember one of the Training Thoughtfully conferences that Kay Lawrence hosted. We were playing the various versions of the table games. So Kay's table game, she's the originator of the table games. So if we're talking about Kay's table games, it's Janabicab. If we're talking about the way that Jesus then modified that and turned it into Portal, the Portable Operant Research and Teaching Lab, it's not really relevant to this particular story, but we were playing table games and Kay had set us a puzzle. So you have various small objects that you can use within a shaping procedure. And some of the objects are token reinforcers. Other objects are things that you want your learner to manipulate in a particular way. And most people want to engage with this. They're very happy to engage with it. They signed up for the conference. They're good to go. You know, they're open to exploring ideas in a variety of ways. But one person was really, really struggling. And we talked about it afterwards. And she said, you know, when I was little, board games were not fun. You know, when you played the old-fashioned board games, my family, we always got into fights. And I hate board games. And so for her, these table games were too close to the board games. And she was struggling. She didn't enjoy it at all. It's like, okay. Now for me, when we were little, we had these treasure hunts. So birthdays, for example, my father would hide clues. And so you'd get the first clue. And that first clue would, when you solved it, you would find the next clue. And when you solved that, you would find the next clue. And eventually what you would find was the present, which was the whole point of the treasure hunt. Well, when you found the present, there was a lot of, oh, yay, you know, we found it, hooray, hooray. And then there was also a feeling of, oh, darn, the game is over. Because mm-hmm. what was really fun was the puzzle solving. And if the puzzles were a little too hard and we were struggling to solve the puzzle, we would, you know, give us a hint. We need a hint. If my father thought that we could solve the puzzle, he would just, you know, he'd just sort of rock back on his heels and, you know, look, no, I'm not going to say anything. And if he thought that, yes, he had made the puzzle a little too hard, and we clearly were not getting it, he would give us a small hint. And from there, we could usually solve the puzzle. So I learned from that and from other experiences, I learned that puzzles are fun, that puzzles are solvable. So, you know, even if the puzzle was a little hard at first, that you could solve the puzzle, and that solving the puzzle led to more puzzles, which was great fun, and solving more puzzles often led to the, you know, the end treasure, whatever that was. I can remember many of the clues. I can't remember a single one of the presents.
That was the punchline for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think, and then we're going to make the parallel with our horses, but that's very interesting. You know, it wasn't about the reward at the end. The reward was the puzzle itself.
Yes, the process, the whole process. Yeah. And but if maybe everybody else was solving the puzzle and I never could, maybe I've grown up hating puzzles.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, because let's say, again, I'm thinking of our horses, that you set up a situation where you close some doors and there's always one door open, but then you're putting pressure on the other end to solve the puzzle. And right. If you solve it quick enough, well, you know, you'll feel that little whip at the end there. Well, right. That's also a different situation.
Right. And so that, you know, there are lots of ways where you can spoil the joy of puzzle solving.
Yes.
And there are lots of ways that you can enhance, support, build the joy of puzzle solving. So I think this enjoyment of puzzles really does, it predisposes me to understand and enjoy clicker training, set the stage for my enjoying clicker training, for understanding clicker training, for seeing it as a series of puzzles, and for understanding that we have to teach our learners how to solve puzzles, how to become a confident puzzle solver, because it's not a given. You're not born, oh, this individual will be a really good puzzle solver, and this one will be crummy at it. This is a skill that you develop over time.
And sometimes in our system, it's crushed.
Absolutely. Yes. Not sometimes, many times, most of the time. You know, when you see school, by the time kids get through a few years of school, their joy in puzzle solving, at least within the kinds of puzzles that are set within a teaching system and a school system, it's just really dried up to nothing. But
even better avoid it.
No, but then you see the joy with which the addiction that they have for video games. So there's clearly something that can be ignited there in terms of puzzle solving. So I always think of things like the Sudoku puzzle books. And if you get a really well-designed Sudoku puzzle book, if you don't know how to solve a Sudoku puzzle, the first puzzles are really easy. They sort of show you the general overview. And then they move you as you figure out, oh, well, I'm supposed to, you know, fill in all the numbers and have the, you know, the whole way that Sudoku works. And And then they start getting a little bit harder, and you see the logic behind different ways of solving the puzzles. For example, if the puzzles jumped from really easy to really hard, then once you got the hang of, well, this is how you play Sudoku, and then suddenly you're confronted with a puzzle that's really hard, and where you don't have the repertoire in place of having solved other puzzles and figured out the logic behind them, you would really be struggling, and you would get frustrated, and you would quit and go away. And you would say, oh, I hate Sudoku. I don't want to play. If they stay too easy for too long, you'll get bored.
Yeah.
And you'll go away. So you need to learn how to set a puzzle well at the beginning. Yeah. So it is well within the puzzle solving capabilities.
And it's not just at the beginning. The way you set up puzzle in the beginning is very important. But I think it's important throughout, you know, even when you get to more advanced, every time you're resetting the puzzle.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the things you mentioned in the course, and I think you talked about it in the last coaching session, which I missed, unfortunately. It's one of the rare ones that I missed because I had a prior engagement that I really couldn't move. But I know you talked about nudges coming from the thoughtful arranging of puzzles, of the environment, and of course, noticing small changes, which turn into small shifts in criteria. And one of the things you say in the course is that if you're teaching well, the next step should never be hard. Right. Even if you're in a very advanced exercise, the next step should never be hard.
Yeah, it should feel like just a small step away from where you are. Say you're looking at a complex math equation, and you've got it up on a blackboard, and you're looking at this, you know, all these peculiar symbols and signs and numbers and letters that, and you know it's some form of math equation, but my goodness, you don't even know where to begin to interpret it. Well, that's because you don't have the repertoire in place to interpret it. And I think about if I went back and looked at my university notes and looked at some of the equations that once upon a time I understood and could solve because the repertoire was current and I could follow the steps. So by the time you're looking at that complex equation, you have in repertoire the ability to solve it. And so it doesn't look difficult, or challenging, or totally beyond you. It looks well within the range of what you can work on. But if you're at the stage of 2 + 2 = 4, it looks impossible. Mm-hmm. And that's the same with horse training. If you look at something where, for example, if you looked at Piaf and you think, oh, that's so beautiful, I would love for my horse to do that. But I could never teach that. That's just, it's too far away from where I am. I'm that lament of, I'm just a trail rider. But by the time you and your horse have the puzzle pieces in place, what seemed like something that was impossible to achieve is now just a simple, small step, small request away, and for both you and your horse. So if you're banging away at your horse and thinking, you know, this feels hard, and it is hard, then it means that there is repertoire missing. That's the whole constructional training perspective. There's repertoire missing. And as you build those skills and put them in place, and you put the concepts in place that bind these different skills together, so a horse understands how chains work, then what looked like a really complex behavior becomes an achievable behavior.
And for me, thinking about training this way, it helps me not to stay too long and hit that glass ceiling, not to stay too long at the same place. And so when I'm preparing my training sessions, I always think, how can I nudge just a little bit what I did the last time?
Right.
How can I extend it just a little bit? And that way, I'm always evolving, and it's very fluid, but we're always expanding a little bit.
Yeah, and it's, I would say, it's very seamless, because the shift over time, it doesn't have big sort of bumps in the road. You're not encountering the big bumps in the road. And if you do encounter a bump in the road, you back off a little bit and you think about what else could be going on, what's going on today, what's changed, what could I do differently, so that you're not, it's not like we're going into spring mud season. It's not like you've got your car caught in the mud and you're putting your foot on the accelerator and your wheel is spinning, and your tire is getting deeper and deeper and deeper caught in this muddy rut. It's not like that at all. You know, you're seeing a little bit of difficulty, you back off, you assess, you shift something a little bit, and then when you move forward, you're moving forward with a nudge, is such a good word, with these little nudges and not big pushes. If you're trying to push, or if you find yourself pushing, there's something missing. There's a piece missing.
And I know I love to learn this way myself. You know, it's true for our horses. It's true for us. You know, when you were saying, to this day, I still love solving puzzles because of the way your father set up the whole thing. I'm realizing more and more over the years how much of what I'm using to teach the horses, I'm using on myself in my life.
Oh, interesting. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I've recently, there's a big tradition in my village of amateur theater. I love my village. You know, there's a sense of community here that I just love. And it's English theater. And so I decided to register to a theater course. And at the end of the course, we were doing this play that we kind of wrote, all of us together.
Oh, very fun.
So I had to learn my lines, right?
Right.
And I use so much of what I've learned about chaining, learning my lines. You know, so for instance, I did it forward chaining, and then I did it back chaining in a way. Oh. You know, what I call back chaining, meaning, let's say the script was 12 pages. So I would do from page 1 to page 12, but then I would also do sometimes, let's say, from page 11 and 12, and then 9, 10, 11, and 12. You know, I would go backwards like that. And I could see my colleagues had only done forward chaining because most of them were really good in the first half and forgot a lot of their lines during rehearsals and even during the performance. But, you know, it doesn't matter. It's amateur theater, right. So it's not a big deal. But I could see that they mastered the first half much better. And it was clear to me that they had done forward chaining, where I had done both. And I had also applied, you know, when we say in a chain, when you have a weak link in a chain, you should pull that out and work on that and then put it back in the chain.
Yes.
So there were sentences where I would trip on a few words. Like there was this sentence that said, the sentence was about a book from Darwin. So that just really quickly, we wrote this play together. And of course, I had to put Darwin in somewhere, you know, animals a little bit somewhere in that play. The play was happening at the end of the Victorian era.
Okay.
And so a little bit after Darwin had published his book on the origin of species. And I was married to a wealthy man, and he was very he thought that book was dangerous because it challenged all the foundations of the beliefs of the time. And because remember, God created everything in 7 days, right?
Right.
So this idea of the evolution was not very welcomed in the beginning by religion. And so I had this phrase, this sentence I had to say, you know, rest assured, my faith remains intact. Reading Darwin's book has only deepened my awe for the intricate beauty of God's creation. And I kept tripping on my awe for the intricate beauty of God's creation. So I took that part out and I just repeated that part. And I can tell you in the end, it was one of the easiest parts for me to say, because I worked just, if I had redone all the sentence, I think I would have, I don't know, gotten bored but just working. And there were a few sentences like that where I just pulled out a few of the words where I was tripping and worked on these few words, just as we do with our animals, and put it back in the chain. And I went through my lines. I mean, I didn't forget anything. Even that sentence, the colleague who was playing with me, he made a mistake in his lines and he went too far ahead. And I wanted to say my line because I had learned it, you know? And so I found a way to bring it back later. But, you know, I find I'm doing this in my life a lot, that I apply things I have learned over the years with positive reinforcement, clicker training, and I use it to learn, to create good habits, to whatever. And I love it, of course, because, you know, we know that the way we teach, just the way your father set up those puzzles, create good emotion, good feelings, loving learning.
As I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, what a wonderful confirmation it is, you know, in terms of, we say, you know, back chain, and back chaining is a, you know, this is how it works, and the whole process. And then when you experience it yourself, and you can see the contrast with the people who only used forward chaining. Mm-hmm. It really gives you a powerful example, non-example confirmation that these concepts are useful and they're valid. So it's a wonderful way of really owning the concepts that we're talking about. You know, and that's related. You started off with the talking about the rope handling. And the rope handling, it's complex. And for many people, they want to avoid the use of lead ropes because of the experiences that they've had when they've been in more traditional horse training. And lead ropes have been...
I'm one of them, as you know.
Yeah, and lead ropes are used in a really punitive way. When I first stumbled across clicker training, which is 1993, one of the things that attracted me to clicker training that sort of made me sit up and take notice was watching a mastiff puppy being trained to sit and lie down, and the handler never touched the puppy. And it was like, wow, that's really cool. Because the dog training that I had seen up to that point had all been some version of jerk and pull. You know, the dog doesn't do what you want, you jerk on the chain collar. And that was dog handling. So I can totally understand that if that's been your experience, whether we're talking about dog training or horse training, that the idea that you can take the leash off completely and train your animal, that you can train your dog to sit and lie down and come to you, and you can train all these fun behaviors and never put a lead on them, is very appealing. And the same thing with horses, the idea that you can use targeting and free shaping, for example, and interact with your horse at liberty is very, very appealing. But we do put halters and lead ropes on horses, and for often for safety. You know, when my horses were at the boarding barn, one of the rules was that if you were taking your horse out of its stall, and it had to be on a lead rope. So you couldn't just have the horse walk along next to you the way I can at my own barn. The horse had to be on a lead. And, you know, I get that. You're in a public boarding barn. I get that they would want that for safety. They don't want people getting casual and thinking that the horse is going to follow them and then the horse doesn't. And then we want to ride, and riding is tactile. You know, riding is tactile cues. So for me, it was never, ever about, well, I'm not going to use lead ropes. I'm going to take away all of the lead rope communication, because the lead rope can be such a wonderful, wonderful communication tool. And we've talked about this many times on the various podcasts, how the lead rope is, you know, it's shaping on a point of contact. So you are setting puzzles. You are closing some doors and opening others, but the tactile information, so it's, you know, it does work as an on-off. You take the slack out of the lead, so there's pressure. You release the lead, there you turned off. So you say, when you slide up the lead rope, you're saying, I want something. When you release the lead, you're saying, thank you, you just gave it to me. But when you slide up the lead rope, you're only going to a point of contact, or we could call it a point of awareness, a point of connection. You're not going beyond that into escalating, fear-inducing, discomfort-inducing escalation of pressure. So it should remain always just information, a clue that the learner uses to get to his reinforcement faster, where it's very
not to avoid,
but it's like playing the game hot and cold. You're in a room and you've been told that there is a wonderful treasure hidden somewhere in this room, and so you're going to move around the room. And wouldn't it be lovely if somebody was there to say, oh, you're getting a little colder. Oh, okay. I won't go down into that part of the room. I'll move to this part. Oh, you're getting hotter. You're getting warmer. This is great. No, you're getting a little colder now. Oh, okay. Let me turn away from there and move to this part of the room. So you're providing information. Don't go there. That's not going to get you closer to the answer. Try over there instead. And then the other part of this was a comment that one of the participants in the online course was one of the responses to questions I was posing. She was saying she's fairly new to clicker training, and she was in the last coaching session as well. So this was related to some of what she saw in the coaching session. She was appreciating seeing that we did set boundaries, that it wasn't, well, the horse can do anything he wants, because she had been a little worried about that. Right. That, and so positive reinforcement training is not about being permissive. You know, it's not about, the old thing with the children that where the parent takes the child into the grocery store and the child is pulling the cereal boxes off the shelf and the parent is just going, oh, well, he's just learning, you know, he can do whatever he likes. That's being permissive. No, you are creating structures, you're creating expectations, but you're not grabbing the child by the wrist, hauling the child off his feet and smacking him and saying, don't ever do that again in the grocery store aisle. You're not doing any of that. You are managing the environment. You're building the skills needed for the child to be able to join you at the grocery store and stay with you at the grocery store, and for it to be a pleasure to go shopping with this child, which is doable. You know, I've seen it in grocery stores. We see all kinds of things in grocery stores. Yeah. But, you know, it's not about being permissive. It is positive reinforcement. We are creating good, safe ground manners, space management between horse and human. We have to, or it would become dangerous to be around the horses. We'll end here. Dominique is about to change topics for us. Though actually, it really isn't a change of topics. Dominique wants to talk about rope handling. And puzzle setting and puzzle solving are an important part of rope handling. So one topic flows well into the other. Puzzle setting sits behind what I refer to as shaping on a point of contact. Dominique has been going through my online rope handling course, and she's discovered that there are a lot of great topics to cover. In this current episode, she shared with us her experience learning her lines for a theater group using back chaining. So we've talked about back chaining and forward chaining. And in this next episode, we're going to add another teaching strategy, which is reversibility. And we're going to look at some techniques people can use to teach themselves new skills. That's an important part of being able to shift from the make it happen rope handling that many people start out with to a more clicker compatible version of rope handling, which uses shaping on a point of contact. So until next time, train well and have fun with clicker training.